Great, so I'm going to be talking about studying variability in the ultraviolet with the GALAX satellite. And I'm talking about variability on both short and long time scales, so both flares and flashes. This is work that I'm doing as a postdoc at Caltech, and I'm working with the GALAX team at Caltech and in Marseille. So in my talk first, I'm going to introduce the capability of GALAX to study variability. Then I'm going to introduce the topic of tidal disruption flares and talk about our search for these flares with GALAX. And then I'm going to talk about interesting results from the search for very fast variability from stars. And I'm going to briefly describe plans for a future dedicated time domain survey. So GALAX has the unique ability to probe variability on the time scale of milliseconds to years. And this is due to the availability of time-tagged photon data with a time resolution as good as 5 milliseconds, as well as deep imaging survey fields which have deep exposures of greater than 30 kiloseconds, which require baseline of observations of 2 to 3 years due to target visibility and mission planning. So we can really have cadences ranging from milliseconds to years. In addition, GALAX has very large field of view, 1.2 square degrees, and a large survey volume, which is good for the serendipitous discovery of variable objects. The UV sky is very dark, and you can detect the source with as little as 10 photons. And GALAX obtains simultaneous near UV and far UV imaging, and there's also the possibility to get simultaneous far UV and near UV spectroscopic grism data, low resolution. So shown here are the sensitivity curves of GALAX in the far UV and near UV in comparison to the Sloan Digital Sky Survey filters. And overplotted are galaxy templates for different star formation histories ranging from the youngest to the oldest. And really the GALAX satellite was designed to map the star formation history of galaxies out to a redshift of 2. However, I'm going to be talking about how we can take advantage of the far UV sensitivity of the satellite to probe for high energy flashes and flares. So a tidal disruption event occurs when a star passes within the tidal disruption radius of a supermassive black hole lying in the center of a galaxy. And so the equation for the tidal disruption radius is given here. And for a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole and a solar type star, this tidal disruption radius is about 25 times the Schwarzschild radius. So here's a simulation of what happens to a solar-type star around a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole. This little circle is the Schwarzschild radius. And you can see that the star is torn apart due to the tidal forces of the black hole. About 50 to 75% of the stellar debris will be ejected at high velocities, but some fraction will remain bound to the black hole and fall back on eccentric orbits, resulting in a luminous accretion flare. The brightest flares will occur near 10 to the 6 to 5 times 10 to the 7 solar mass black holes because the stellar debris accretes in a thick disk that radiates close to the Eddington luminosity. I should note that for higher mass central black holes, greater than 10 to the 8 solar masses, the tidal disruption radius is actually smaller than the Schwarzschild radius, so we will not be able to detect any flares from such events. So we're really probing black holes on the range from 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 7 solar masses. The spectrum of these flares can be characterized by the effective temperature of a disk radiating at the Eddington luminosity at the distance of the tidal disruption radius, and that's about 3 times 10 to the 5th Kelvin. And this temperature is very weakly dependent on the central black hole mass. So in fact, all of these tidal disruption events are going to have roughly the same characteristic temperature. The luminosity of the flare will decline over time with an analytically and determined declining mass accretion rate of t to the minus 5/3. So both, and you can do this analytically and with simulations, you see that there will always be this characteristic power law decay of the flare. Now, the frequency with which these events occur depends on the details of the stellar dynamics of the galaxy's nucleus. And recent calculations by Wang and Merritt find that the tidal disruption rate is dependent both on the stellar velocity dispersion in the nucleus and inversely dependent on the central black hole mass. So in fact, as you increase the black hole mass, your tidal disruption rate gets smaller. So if you use this relationship and then combine it with the observed relationship between stellar velocity dispersion in the bulges of galaxies and their central black hole masses, you can get a black hole mass dependent tidal disruption rate here, and you end up getting an event rate about 10 to the minus 4 per year. So tidal disruption theory predicts rare but luminous flares that peak in the UV X-ray domain and decay on the time scale of months.
Excuse me, is the
yes.
rate for a single galaxy or?
Yes, per galaxy. So at once every 10,000 years, a star will come within the tidal disruption radius in a galaxy.
What's roughly the luminosity?
The Eddington luminosity, so around 10 to the 45 ergs per second, and it scales with black hole mass. So why should we look for these tidal disruption events? Well, they're an unambiguous probe for supermassive black holes lurking in the nuclei of otherwise quiescent normal galaxies. And they may contribute to black hole growth over cosmic times, and also may contribute to the faint end of the X-ray luminosity function for AGN. And as I described, the luminosity temperature and decay curve of the flare is directly dependent and on the mass and spin of the central black hole. So by measuring the properties of these flares in detail, we can actually probe the properties of the black hole itself. In addition, the tidal disruption rates are also sensitive to the structure and dynamics of the stellar nuclei. And so if we can get a handle of the tidal disruption rate, we're also probing the structure of the stellar nuclei. So the ROSAT All-Sky Survey was an excellent experiment to search for these events, since it sampled hundreds of thousands of galaxies in the soft X-ray band from 0.1 to 2.4 kiloelectron volts. And in fact, the ROSAT All-Sky Survey did observe five large amplitude soft X-ray flares, two of which came from Seyfert galaxies, but three of which came from galaxies that showed no previous evidence for AGN activity. And these flares had extremely soft blackbody temperatures of 6 to 12 times 10 to the 5th Kelvin, high X-ray luminosities of 10 to the 42 to 10 to the 44 ergs per second, and the duration of the flares was on the time scale of months. And from the statistics of the survey, Donnelly et al. 2002 calculated an event rate of about 1 times 10 to the minus 5th per year per galaxy. So all of these are properties that you would expect from a tidal disruption event. And in particular, if these galaxies are in fact non-active, then large amplitude soft X-ray flares are best explained as due to tidal disruption events. So to investigate this, we obtained sensitive Chandra imaging and STIS spectroscopy 10 years later for the three flares that occurred in galaxies classified as non-active. And all three galaxies had decayed in their X-ray luminosities by factors of 240 to 6,000. So this large amplitude in decay is consistent with this T to the minus 5/3 power law decay. In addition, STIS narrow slit spectroscopy for two of the galaxies confirmed their ground-based classification as non-active, because there was no evidence for emission lines or a non-stellar continuum that would be indicative of permanent AGN activities. So these two galaxies, which appear to be quiescent, are the best candidates so far for a tidal disruption event. One of the galaxies, NGC 5905, the narrow slit STIS spectra did reveal a low luminosity Seyfert in the inner 0.1 arc seconds of the nucleus. Ground-based spectra had classified the galaxy as a starburst galaxy, and the Seyfert nucleus was masked by the H2 regions in ground-based spectra. But when you put in the narrow slit, you can see in the diagnostic diagrams that the narrow emission line ratios have to be powered by a Seyfert nucleus. However, of all the galaxies, this galaxy had the best monitored X-ray light curve. And in fact, the decay of the flare is very nicely fit with the T to the minus 5/3 power law. And the details of the luminosity and decay of the flare were modeled successfully as the partial stripping of a low mass star or by the disruption of a brown dwarf or giant planet by Li et al. 2002. So here's a case where we know there's a low luminosity Seyfert in the nucleus, but we still see a luminous soft X-ray flare with the characteristics of a tidal disruption event. So why should we search for these events with Galax? Well, the Galax far UV band is sensitive to the Rayleigh gene's tail of the soft X-ray blackbody emission of these flares. And in fact, as you go to higher redshift, the K correction brings us closer to the peak of the blackbody emission. It's much better to look in the far UV than in the optical because of two effects. It's better contrast because the bulge luminosities in the far UV are two magnitudes fainter, and the flare intrinsic flare luminosities are brighter by two magnitudes. So in order to search for flares, I've divided six deep imaging survey fields, which have long exposure times, which have a baseline of observations of 2 to 3 years. And I've divided up the long integrations into yearly coads that range in integration time of 10 kiloseconds to 50 kiloseconds. And then I've aligned the images and done image subtraction to look for variable sources. And I also have TO observations with Chandra and Keck ready to follow up our best candidate flares. And this will be sort of the first opportunity to really measure the properties of these flares, many wavelengths, and catch the early decay of the flares for the first time. So in order to calculate a detection rate with Galax, here I've plotted the parent far UV magnitudes of flares from 10 to the 6 to 5 times 10 to the solar mass black holes, assuming that the flares radiate at the Eddington luminosity, in comparison to the detection limit of a 10 kilosecond DIS exposure. And here you can really see how the K correction makes the unextincted flares detectable out to extremely high redshifts. And to get a detection rate, I take the black hole mass dependent tidal disruption rate times the number of black holes, and that I get by taking the elliptical S0 luminosity function and then taking the relationship between the luminosity of the bulges and the masses of their central black holes using various relationships, including the black hole mass stellar velocity dispersion relationship. And then I multiply that by the volume to which you can detect a flare in a 10 kilosecond DIS exposure. And this yields an event rate of 5 events per year per square degree for redshift less than 1 that could be detected by Galax. So what are my flare candidates so far? Shown here is a candidate selected in the growth field, and it was selected because of its large amplitude of variability between 2003 and 2005. And I've broken down the coads to create a more detailed light curve. And you can see in 2003, there's just an upper limit detection. And in 2005, there's an increase in magnitude by over 2 magnitudes and then subsequent decay of the flare. And in fact, this flare was detected in the optical. This is data from the CFH-TLS survey, and you can see that the host of the flare is in fact an optically resolved galaxy, which is very exciting. And you can see that the variable portion of the galaxy is in the nucleus. And shown here, the optical light curve actually catches the peak of the flare. And so if I use the location of the peak of the flare, I can then constrain my T to the minus 5/3 power law, which depends on the time of the tidal disruption event and the time of the peak of the emission. And shown here very lightly is the best fit curve. And the black hole mass parameters that you get from that fit are reasonable. They range from 10 to the 6 to 2 times 10 to the 7 solar masses. However, the actual light curve looks a lot steeper than T to the minus 5/3 power law. And in fact, this galaxy is a Seyfert galaxy at a redshift of 0.355, and very faint, but we obtained a spectrum in January from MDM, and this is sort of the limits of capabilities of MDM to take a spectrum of this galaxy, but it has narrow emission lines indicative of a Seyfert spectrum. And in fact, there was an archival Chandra detection in April 2002 indicating that it's a low luminosity Seyfert. And if you look at the SED of the flare itself, I've shown here the from the optical to the far UV, and you can see that the SED looks a lot flatter than you would expect if it were a black body peaking in the soft X-rays. And it looks also flatter than a mu to the minus one Seyfert-like power law. But in general, the presence of persistent Seyfert activity makes this large amplitude flare, it's difficult to prove that it's a tidal disruption event. Another candidate, yes? It's in the middle. So this is the supernova software that they have in the center of the galaxy. Another candidate discovered in the growth field, again, it was selected because of the large amplitude of variability between 2003 and 2005. And again, there's an upper limit in 2003. And then an increase in magnitude of over 2.5 magnitudes and a subsequent decay of the flare. And in fact, the solid line shows the best fit T to the minus 5/3 power law. Yeah. Okay. And this would be the time of the tidal disruption event for that fit, which is consistent. It would be in 2004. However, again, the variability was detected in the optical, and in fact, it looks like an optically unresolved quasar. And you can see that the supernova software detected it as a variable source in the optical, and the catalog colors from CFHTLS and other sources show that, in fact, this source, which is shown at the star, and the color diagrams does look like is optically identified as a quasar. So it looks like I've found two very interesting active galaxies, which is not what I'm looking for. I'm really looking for a quiescent galaxy that has a far UV flare that can only be attributed to a tidal disruption event. However, I have many more candidates, and all of these have variability of at least a magnitude. And the key to solving the mystery of all these sources is multi-wavelength data, especially optical colors. So I'm in the process of getting those for these candidates, if they're available. So I also wanted to describe very exciting results from looking for fast variability from stars. And this is work done by the group at Berkeley with Barry Welsh and Jonathan Wheatley. And they have detected, just by comparing catalogs from individual visits of fields, which range from 100 seconds to 1,500 kiloseconds, they've found already 84 variable sources, most of which are R. Olyri stars and M. dwarf flare stars. And what's really exciting for studying flare stars with Galax is that you can construct very detailed high signal-to-noise light curves from the time-tagged photon data. And you can get a resolution as good as on the order of milliseconds. So shown here are some of the very interesting light curves of these flare stars, including the most spectacular flare star ever observed, which showed an increase in brightness by 20,000 in less than 200 seconds. These are seconds, so this is usually it's about 100, yeah, this is I think 100, 200, 300 seconds, like that. So we have plans for, in 2008, once the main mission goals of Galax have been completed, to do the first dedicated time domain survey in the UV. And this would be designed to complement future ground-based time domain surveys such as PanSTARRS and LSST. And the idea would be that all time domain products, especially variable object alerts, would be made public immediately to the community for follow-up. And in addition, the pipeline would produce automated triggers to generate IAU and GCN circulars. And we would really be taking advantage of the fact that many of these flaring objects are UV bright in their early evolution. And so if we have Galax to find these sources in their early stages, we can then trigger alerts so that the community can follow them up at other wavelengths. So there's a whole host of astronomical objects that could be detected with such a survey. And shown here are sort of a sketch of what the survey could look like with different cadences from days to weeks to months, and different depths from ranging from 100 seconds to 10 kiloseconds, with different frequencies of visits, and both wide surveys and, for example, just monitoring a cluster like the Virgo or Fornax cluster. Another great thing about the TDS survey is really we're getting a lot of these observations by free by just more carefully planning out the already extended mission plans of Galax by deliberately planning the cadence of the observations instead of just having the time domain in mind as they do the mission planning. So you can see that we've already found some really exciting variable objects by using data that hasn't been designed for variability studies. So such a dedicated time domain survey would yield a lot more exciting results.
How many galaxies did you effectively look at to find those two or three transits that you showed?
So I'm looking for flares from hosts, basically either early type spiral galaxies or elliptical galaxies. So the flares are coming from galaxies that wouldn't be detected by Galax normally. They're not far UV bright. So from my luminosity, I would say at least around 10 to the 6 galaxies.
For the tidal disruption, one suggestion and one question. So the suggestion is, I don't think it helps to look at distant objects here, because there's always weird things going on at quasars, and to separate that from a tidal thing. So I think even though you may get 5 per year to redshift 0.1, I think it's better to focus really hard on the nearest one, in my mind. Otherwise, you'll spend a lot of time with inconclusive results at high redshift. When high, I mean one is in this game to be a high redshift.
So what is less conclusive, the separating the properties of the nucleus from the galaxy, or?
Well, it seems to me, I mean, you know, to show this is really happening, you want to say it's not a real AGN.
So right.
You want detailed spectra, you want to know the radio properties and what have you. But
at least 30% of normal galaxies show signs of AGN spectra when you look hard enough, so that doesn't help.
Well, but making it more distant won't help it even more.
So you get more.
Yeah, but having more objects would help.
I'm not sure. The question I had was, what next? Okay, you've got some really interesting events, but what is the killer observation that will say this is a tidal disruption thing?
What I'm really looking for is a candidate that has no evidence for sort of Seyfert or quasar-like activity in the existing, multi-wavelength data or archival data. And then I would use my Chandra TOO to get a X-ray point, and I would do a deep spectrum. And at that point, you're either looking for the decay of the event, or you're looking for emission from the debris itself. But it's one of these problems where even the best candidates that were detected by ROSAT, we put in proposals, say, can we look at it again, you know, a couple years later to make sure it's still quiet? Because that's really the only way to rule out this from sort of AGN fluctuations, that it was in fact a one-time event. So I guess the answer would be sort of really proving that this flare is continuing to decay and there's no other signs for AGN activity in the host.
John. Two questions.
One is it absolutely the case that these things have to be black bodies, or can there sort of be a modified black body or other sort of things coming in?
Right, so in fact, no tidal disruption flares have really definitively been observed in the optical. There was that one candidate in the lensed cluster. So already my flares look, both of these flares were seen in the optical, which is not what I was expecting. So it may be that our understanding of the temperature of the flares is wrong. There's also predictions that over much longer time scales, the disruption debris settles down in a more stable thin accretion disk that has cooler temperatures and a less steep spectrum.
Which would also affect the light curve, probably, it wouldn't have to be minus
30. Yes, but then the argument against that has been that that stage is a much longer time scale event, and so that's not what we would be detecting.
So the second question is, do you have enough coverage in frequency space just with Galax to be able to say whether it looks like it's a black body or whether it looks sort of flat enough that you don't want to go after it another way?
I mean, I would hope you can see sort of that, I mean, the near UV should be fainter. I mean, there's a characteristic color, there's a characteristic magnitude difference, you know, from my models of 0.7. So theoretically, I should have a very distinctive color between the far UV and near UV, but I'm not confident yet to use that as selection criteria.
Okay. How many square degree years did you really survey to get your events? I mean, you were requiring them to come up and then go down again, so there's sort of a little peak around the middle of the...
Right. I've looked briefly at 6 square degrees.
Square degree years.
Right, so you have to take into account that you're only sampling once a year. So I haven't done a simulation yet to see, you know, given the decay curve, what your actual detection rate is given the sampling. So it's going to be less than 5.
Okay, Josh?
About flare stars, you mentioned one went in brightness by a factor of 20,000. Is that in your UV band passes, and is that the artifact of the fact that it's a red dwarf, so it doesn't have any UV flux to begin with?
You mean, was it undetected? Is it beyond the detection limit?
The flux ratio in one of your UV bands.
Yes, that is in the far UV.
Far is way down the mean side of the Planck curve, then of course you can get huge ratios. The more interesting number would be to put a volumetric luminosity ratio.
Instead of in the far UV.
Flare generating than say a star does in steady state.
Right. There's a paper on that object by, I think it's Robinson. So you can look to see what that ratio is.
Yeah, I guess my question is along the lines of Charisse and Josh. Basically, is there any prediction for the optical kind of spectrum for these kind of events? Because we have been doing this for a couple of years.
Yeah.
It's our super-low search. And in the process, we discover a lot of several like varying narrow line super galaxies. And
mm-hmm.
A couple for super-low in the middle of the galaxies. But then we stopped doing that because we didn't know what the spectra would look like. For a tidal disruption event?
Well, I was expecting for, you would think that the tidal disruption events would be 2 magnitudes fainter in the optical based on just the black body. However, the bulk, I think the biggest constraint, which is the reason why I should use my Chandra TO, is that the bulk of the emission it's supposedly happening in the soft X-rays and X-rays. So, for example, I don't feel comfortable doing an estimate on the total luminosity of the flare, how much mass was accreted, because I don't really know what's going on in that regime. So I think that might be important to measure.
The bulk of the emission from this supermassive black hole
should be in the soft X-rays.
From the entire galaxy data, if you remove the flare stars and line, can you tell us approximately what is the number of transients?
Yeah, so fortunately, stars are not a contaminant for me because I'm using such long exposure coads of 10 kiloseconds. So my sources are all AGNs, and I'm finding in each field around 10. It depends what you mean by variable, but...
Not variable, transients.
Transients. So far, I would say that those two in the growth field were the only pure transients that I've...
And are you looking for shorter time scales on the entire Galaxy dataset?
Yes, so they're investigating, they're looking for flare stars on time scales of hundreds of seconds. And then I want to find faint things, so I don't want to divide up my exposures to much shorter than 10 kiloseconds, because I want to be able to probe galaxies out to moderate redshifts.
Just one more optical question. So the optical Langer law is not the place to look, it's the place where all the surveys are.
Mm-hmm.
So are you saying that if you have a galaxy or something, a galaxy over 5 years, and it goes, you see some event, and that all the supernova searching people said, oh, probably an AGN, it's right there in the center or something. What's the characteristic that would make you think it's not just some sort of variable AGN? Would it be you see it, it's in the center, it goes for a few months, and you still see it next
and
week?
And then it continues to decay. Right, it continues to decay with this power law signature, and there was no previous evidence for AGN activity. And it's supposed to be a high-energy event, so it's supposed to be much brighter at shorter wavelengths. So you would expect to detect it in the UV or X-rays.
All right. Next time you speak up again. And the next speaker is Jim.